All right, thank you. Thank you very much for being here. I've decided at the last minute to change my title and to dedicate it to the occulture. My new title is, I am sitting in a room different from the one whales are in now. Remember Whale Song? Me neither. We are far, far away from what bioacousticians Roger Payne and Scott McVeigh described as the quiet age of sail. In their article, Songs of Humpback Whales, which appeared on the cover of Science magazine in August 1971. Quiet seas meant that whalers could occasionally hear sounds of whales through the wooden hulls of their ships. In this noisy century, they write, referring, of course, to the 20th, the widespread use of propeller ships and continuously running shipboard generators made this a rare occurrence. It was World War II research into sonar and anti-submarine warfare that made it possible to capture cetacean sounds by means of the new technologies, and we began to hear whales again. Or, since this was a significantly different experience than hearing through a wooden hull, to hear them for the first time. By 1971, most recordings were of odontocetes, or toothed whales, like dolphins, orcas, belugas, and sperm whales, whose vocalizing consists primarily of clicks, squeals, and squeaks. It wasn't until the recordings of the great mysticetes, or baleen whales, that it seemed appropriate to refer to whale sounds as songs. Unlike toothed whales, which do not have vocal cords, baleen whales have voice, properly speaking. Although I was reminded to mention this as I heard Barbara talk this morning about breath, voice, and intimacy, baleen whales do not need to exhale in order to vocalize. And it was Frank Watlington's recordings of humpbacks off the coast of Bermuda, taken between 1953 and 1964 with US Navy broadband hydrophones, which Payne subsequently produced as an LP in 1970 that mesmerized the general public. Remember Whale Song? Me too. Songs of the Humpback Whale became one of the most important oral documents of the modern environmental movement. It was central to the Save the Whales campaign, whose originator, Christine Stevens, appeared before Congress during the Marine Mammal Protection Act debates and literally rested her case by playing the album. That same year, 1972, the United Nations Conference on the Human Environment resulted in a global ban on commercial whaling, which holds more or less to this day. Excerpts from the album are currently hurtling through interstellar space on the Voyager Golden Record, among the most important bits of information that humans in 1977 wished to communicate to whatever alien intelligences might intercept them in the distant future. 10 million copies of Songs of the Humpback Whale were inserted into the January 1979 issue of National Geographic. I'm going to say that again. 10 million copies of Songs of the Humpback Whale were inserted into the January 1979 issue of National Geographic, making this the largest single pressing of any album of recorded music. And speaking of voyages, some of you nerds might recall the 1986 film Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, in which Kirk and Spock travel back in time from 2286 to 1986 in order to save Earth from destruction by a mysterious probe emitting an indecipherable signal that has disabled the planet's power grid and is causing massive storms. Spock determines that the probe's signal matches the songs of humpback whales, long since extinct. With Kirk, he travels to 1986 San Francisco to find a pair of living whales and transport them back to 2286, forward back, so they may answer the probe's call and save Earth and all its inhabitants from total and certain destruction. The film was dedicated to the astronauts who had died in the Challenger disaster just months before its release, which was, as you might recall, the beginning of the end of NASA's space shuttle program. Whale Song seemed to belong as much to a forgotten Earth in need of conservation, a quiet age of sail living only in the annals of human memory, as it did to Cold War technoscience, the search for extraterrestrial life, and a future in which we would be remembered by our alien listeners long after we were gone. As much as these were sounds of life, there was always an association with death. Whale death, human death, environmental death. Whale song came from elsewhere. Haunting, haunted, at a distance. The distress call of something endangered. The bottomlessness of loss. Prehistoric, futuristic, astronautically navigating between the two final frontiers. Or exiled in a catapulted time capsule. A sound at and of the very edge of personhood, speech, music, life, breath, and memory. And then, as the Cold War ended and the new environmental legislation allowed whale populations to return to sustainable numbers, whale song more or less disappeared from popular culture. Remember whale song? Me neither. Until 52 Blue came along. You may know him as the world's loneliest whale. A migrating male blue whale singing at 52 hertz, a frequency too high to be heard by other blue whales or fin whales, and there's some speculation about him being a bluefin hybrid. First recorded in 1992, 52 Blue was introduced to the world in 2004 in a scientific article summing up all the trackings of his migration patterns. But it was around 2013, just as the Voyager Golden Record left the solar system, that this became a social media phenomenon. As the popular media began pushing the story, never confirmed by scientists, that 52 Blue's song was a mating call that would never be answered. Not only have indie pop songs and children's books been written about him, but people have appeared on social media as 52 Blue, setting up Facebook pages and Twitter accounts in his name, with posts that call out to others who aren't there. Quote, "Hello! Yoo-hoo! Is anyone out there? Hashtag sad life. I'm so lonely, frowny face. Hashtag lonely. Hashtag forever alone." The latest research continues to point away from this narrative, arguing that anomalous whale sounds are not that unusual, and that there are probably many whales in the same situation as 52. He may happen to be traveling solo, but his situation is not that unique, and therefore less tragic than we imagine. The sounds may also be produced by a group of hybrid whales rather than one individual, since we have yet to actually see the 52 Blue. But these findings have done little to alter one of the most important narratives of loss today. As scientists gently suggest that there may be nothing here to talk about, the internet continues to generate ever more articles, like this year's The Heartbreaking Story of the World's Loneliest Whale, which describes a creature that, quote, roams the world's largest oceans year after year, desperately calling out for a mate, but never finding one. Filmmaker Josh Zeman and actor Adrien Grenier, star of the series Entourage, have teamed up to make a documentary, which they have successfully crowdsourced. At the heart of their Kickstarter campaign is the lovely soundbite that it is not a fundraiser, but a friendraiser for the loneliest whale. They state that what inspired them to make the film is how many people were moved to share the whale's story. Post about it, make work about it, just talk about it in an effort to, quote, connect. Okay, Cupid, but to connect to what exactly? This whale? Whales in general? Other human enthusiasts of this phenomenon? People in general? Remember desperately calling out for a mate but never finding one? Me too. If humpback songs were the soundtrack to our thinking about whale extinction and environmental death, this blue whale song seems to be the soundtrack to another kind of death scene, the attrition of the social, particularly of love, sex, intimacy, friendship, connection, the more libidinal effects of what might be called being heard by another. It is not by accident that cetaceans are enjoying a cultural moment. From 52 Blue to Blackfish to the cover of last May's National Geographic to the chat box dolphin communication experiments co-engineered by Tad Starner, who also happens to be the creator of Google Glass. Let that one sink in for a moment. There is a renewed interest in cetacean intelligence, specifically in the possibility of two-way communication. They are the other most intelligent mammal, the sapiens of the sea, and our faith in their intelligence is grounded in large part in the fact that they too vocalize. This point is so obvious that one need not restate it. Derrida might have called it a bêtise in his book on animals. But despite this ostensibly unfaltering public knowledge, public interest in cetaceans is inconstant. So what does its migration pattern tell us about ourselves? The most interesting recent academic symptom of this is John Durham Peters's The Marvelous Clouds, a book about media that begins from cetaceans and the ocean as medium. That dolphins have society in the absence of physical infrastructure causes him to speculate that their social organization happens entirely on the level of hearing one another speak. Quote, "Humans learned to build ships, track stars, and write programs, and perhaps dolphins, having nothing better to do with their large brains, learned to pluck single voices out of the pitchy tangle of high-frequency noise. If they built an ocean-wide web, it would have no archive but their collective brains, and no search engines but their sonar." End of quote. But Peters' fabulations about what he calls cetacean acoustic intelligence do not cross over to the human sphere. And Peters' wonderful exploration of the specificity of the ocean environment, i.e. everything that makes cetacean life different from human life, bypasses the ways that cetaceans and humans hear each other in Anthropocene conditions. It is, of course, less and less true that humans and cetaceans inhabit two completely separate habitats, one terrestrial and the other marine. From climate change resulting in the death of krill on which entire ocean ecosystems depend, to bioaccumulation of deadly toxins in whale bodies, to accidental deaths from fishing, which have resulted in the recent extinction of the Baiji, the Yangtze River dolphin, pronounced functionally extinct in 2006, the first cetacean species driven to extinction directly by human encroachment on habitat. There is a very literal sense in which hell is people for cetaceans. Ambient marine noise has increased by a magnitude of 2 over the last 60 years, causing behavioral changes in marine mammals, in marine mammals that depend on sonar for their survival. This means that for a blue whale that was born 60 years ago, the distance over which her vocalizations can travel and the vocalizations of others can be heard has decreased from 1,600 kilometers at the time of her birth to 160 kilometers at present. Everything from migration patterns to feeding to mating is affected, and we now know that most strandings or beachings occur because whales get disoriented due to ambient noise. But the behavioral changes include changes in the vocalizations themselves. Recent studies of right whales show that they are literally yelling in order to be heard by each other. Even our beloved 52 Blue has been deepening his voice and is now singing at closer to 47 hertz. And in this, he is not alone. Blue whales as a species have been gradually deepening their calls since 1960, and shipping noise is one of the explanations offered for this change. Noise pollution is a very particular way to imagine environmental crisis. A shift in frame from environment as that which is not social to the complicated relationship between environment and society. Noise means that society always takes place in an environment, and that Anthropocene environmental problems cannot be thought in isolation from social ones. Noise is also the way that hell is other people for us, as we are discovering what is called hidden hearing loss and its attendant social effects. It is hidden because the threshold audiogram, the gold standard test of hearing function, cannot pick it up. Threshold audiograms measure one's ability to detect tones in quiet, while noise-induced hearing loss concerns our ability to hear in noisy conditions. The Environmental Protection Agency reports that noise, not aging, is the leading cause of hearing loss today. The National Institute of Health classifies hearing loss as a communication disorder. Correctly or not, right? We could talk about this, but that's how it's classified. Taking the more sinister implications of these combined claims to their logical conclusion, we can imagine a hearing loss resulting from the unbearable noise of the modern world. A universal socio-environmental disease, as we succumb to the deafening din, both literal and metaphorical, that irrevocably compromises social life, including the very possibility of intimacy. The 2011 film Perfect Sense illustrates precisely this. Extending the failure to that unit of the social that seems uniquely positioned to keep out the outside world, namely the lover's dyad. Two people fall in love while a worldwide epidemic is causing all humans to lose their senses, one sense at a time. As they lose first smell and then taste, we see their relationship become stronger in the face of the catastrophe, which seems only to buffer their intimacy so that every day they become more and more united against the horrors of the outside world. But when they lose hearing, the relationship ends. The deaf are not allowed to leave their homes. And since she can no longer hear him over the phone as he apologizes, they cannot make up after the fight they have had. Even the most airtight lover's dyad cannot handle the loss of hearing. It can't withstand the noise, the particular way that hell is other people today, which Michel Serre describes in Malfeasance as always more than auditory, quote, language garbage, an audiovisual garbage that is so easily changed into money, or fundraisers indistinguishable from friendraisers. In contrast to Songs of the Humpback Whale, 52 Blue has very few actual listeners. Remember his song? Me neither. Given that his cultural significance is based on an entirely oral event, it is extraordinary that there is almost no interest in the sound itself. Granted, unlike the humpback songs, the sounds of 52 need to be sped up to be heard by humans. But still, it seems strange that no one is rushing to produce the album Songs of the World's Loneliest Whale when people are this obsessed. It's ironic that as we strain to connect to this vocalizing and acutely hearing creature, sound is not at all the point. But of course, the production of an album like Payne had done with Watlington's humpback recordings is a quaint anachronism these days. Who makes albums, right? The Song of 52 Blue lives on YouTube, where the closest thing to an album is a small-scale project called The Loneliest Mix, where one can purchase the song custom-made by a guy, God bless this guy, custom-made by a guy on cassette, quote, one mixtape at a time, for $6. As far as I can tell, nobody's buying. As pre and post internet respectively, Songs of the Humpback Whale and 52 Blue are not only different sounds, they exist as products of fundamentally qualitatively different modes of music distribution, different imaginaries of collective experience, different modes of social interaction, and different understandings of what constitutes an environment. As critical animal studies focuses on the affective states of humans towards and about animals, it turns attention away from large-scale affective changes among humans, including ones that have interspecies effects. One example of this is Jamie Lorimer's Wildlife in the Anthropocene, where he argues for a shift from thinking in terms of anthropomorphism to thinking in terms of what he calls the more useful notion of charisma, which environmental scientists have been deploying for years in the term charismatic megafauna, of which whales are, of course, a prime example. But Lorimer's analysis would benefit from a broader look at a loss of charisma among humans. Is it possible that certain species of fauna appear to us as increasingly charismatic the less charismatic we become to each other? So that a desire for connection with humans today looks like sitting in a room different from the one you are in now, surfing YouTube for whale song recordings, and maybe tweeting as 52 Blue about one's loneliness, yelling, if you will, over the din. The values of late capitalist digital culture, speed, exchange, optimization, transparency, absolute communicability, do not allow for what Lyotard calls the thickness of the given, its inherent resistance to language. The Sylvan world, this is Lyotard from Discourse Figure, the Sylvan world continuously falls into oblivion in the process of signification. And I should say that Lyotard did come to me in a dream recently. This is a true story. And I think I had the flu. He came to me in a dream. He walked into my kitchen and told me, and I'm thinking now of Nicola's paper about the sort of academic hermeticism in which we are commenting on each other all the time. Lyotard told me to stop commenting on his work and write something that matters. So, the Sylvan world continuously falls into oblivion in the process of signification, he writes in Discourse Figure. The sensible poses a limit to discourse and means nothing, except perhaps that bodies are full of holes, as he writes in Peregrinations. The same holes by which the Sylvan enters us are the ones that make connection with others possible. But the digital age is the dream of discourse without limits, of perfect synchronization, as Dominic Petman writes about in his forthcoming Infinite Distraction. What? Oh, shit. See, you're too fast for me. Capitalism. Perfect synchronization.
He's underrated.
Yeah. Ahead of his time, really. I'm just going to keep saying perfect synchronization of total archive, and therefore of bodies without holes and minds without memory. Any serious study of the cultural impact or meaning of whale song today must attend to the effects of such a dream, both social and environmental. That whales now sing on the internet matters, as we simultaneously imagine and produce human collectivity over and against that of the other most loquacious, emotionally complex, and social animal on Earth. Thank you.